Tax Update for Saturday, July 29th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, July 29th, 2006. This week, we're going to take a look at the case of whose IRA was it, the issue of surviving spouses and IRAs. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. This podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. In fact, this week's presentation that we're doing the podcast on also previously had an article this week to Limeburg subscribers who have got an email update on this particular case. This week, we're going to take a look at the case of G versus Commissioner, 127 TC number 1, that was decided this week and dealt with a case that all of us run into from time to time. The issue of a surviving spouse and the IRA that she received from her husband. In this case, the question we're going to look at is what happens if that surviving spouse rolls the IRA into an IRA that she owns in her own name, and then down the line wishes to take a distribution, but she has not yet obtained the age of 59 and a half. Can the spouse continue to treat that as being received on the account of being the beneficiary of her former spouse's account, therefore a death benefit that does not have the 10% penalty apply, or does the 10% penalty apply? The tax court decided the penalty would apply. Now, general rule here, a surviving spouse has a choice to make with an IRA account that the spouse who just passed away may have held at their death. The spouse may decide to be treated like any other beneficiary of the account and take the distribution subject to the required distributions under Section 409A9 of the Code. And I suppose we should make clear these days we're talking about 409 little a, not 409 cap a, since Congress confused matters somewhat by adding that provision. But basically, under 409A and the related regulations, you're beneficiary of the account, and generally, if the account was in pay status, in the case of G, we're going to look at an account that apparently was already in pay status, it would come out over the life expectancy of that spouse now as a beneficiary. Or the spouse can elect to treat the IRA as his or her own, in this case, her own, and in that case, roll it into her own name, and then future distributions will be determined based upon that spouse's required minimum distribution from that spouse's IRA account. Now, Regulation 1.408-8, Question 5, deals with the basic rules of a surviving spouse and how the surviving spouse goes about treating an IRA as her own. And that information found at page 2 of the downloaded information you should have when you're listening to this podcast, and I would suggest you get that information before you listen to this podcast. But that information produced there gives us the basic rules about what a spouse does. And that notes that a surviving spouse may elect to treat the spouse's entire interest as beneficiary in an individual's IRA as that spouse's own IRA. It goes on to note you can make that election at any time after the spouse's date of death. In order to make the election, there are a couple of requirements. The spouse must be the sole beneficiary of the IRA and have an unlimited right to withdraw from that IRA. If a trust is named as a beneficiary of the IRA, the requirement is not satisfied even if the spouse is the sole beneficiary of the trust. It goes on to note that if the surviving spouse makes the election, the required minimum distribution for the year of the election and each subsequent year is determined under Section 409A9 Cap A, with the spouse as the IRA owner and not Section 401A9B with the surviving spouse as a deceased IRA's owner's beneficiary. However, as noted, if the election is made in the year containing the IRA's owner's death, the spouse required not take a minimum distribution as IRA owner for the calendar year, Instead, the spouse required to take the minimum distribution for that year determined with respect to the deceased IRA owner under the general rules. Now, a key point that will come up in the G case is how we make this election. And the election described in that paragraph above is made by a surviving spouse redesignated the account as an account in the name of the surviving spouse's IRA owner rather than as beneficiary. Alternatively, the spouse may be deemed to have made the election if any time following the election, any of the following two things occur. Any amount in the IRA that would be required to be distributed to the surviving spouse as the beneficiary under the usual beneficiary rules is not distributed within the time period required for that distribution to be made, or an additional amount is contributed to the IRA which is subject or deemed to be subject to the lifetime distribution requirements on 409A9 Cap A. So basically, if we just simply do nothing, don't take the distribution, and the spouse is not in pay status, you know, our surviving spouse would not be in pay status, which would be the case with the G case, where she was not age over age 70 and a half, in fact was younger than age 59 and a half at the date of her spouse's death. Therefore, if we simply don't take that required distribution, we can be deemed to have made the election to treat it as the surviving spouse's own account. Now, it goes on to note that the result of that election is going to be, if you treat it as your own, is then the surviving spouse shall be treated to consider the IRA owner for whose benefit the trust is maintained for all purposes under the Internal Revenue Code, and specifically notes for purposes of Section 72T. Now, the reason why we usually treat the account as a surviving spouse's is we have much more flexibility here. Generally, we get a slower payout if the surviving spouse's account, because as you may remember, the normal rules for minimum distribution require that we have, during the person's life, the owner's life, we have a dual life expectancy of that person plus a person deemed to be 10 years younger. Once that person passes away and now the distribution is being made as a pure beneficiary, therefore the spouse elects not to treat it as her own, we are down to only that spouse's life expectancy, and basically we're in payout mode where the money will come out of that account. If we, however, treat it as the spouse's in this case because she wasn't over age 70 and a half, we can basically stop the payouts, we can hold the balance in the account, and we will not be required to start distribution until we reach the age at which the surviving spouse hits age 70 and a half, and at that point we'll be able to take the distribution over her life expectancy plus the presumed 10-year younger person expectancy, or if that spouse is married to someone more than 10 years younger than herself at that time, we can extend it even longer. Now, what had been true clearly in this case was that when this account was inherited, we had a person who was more than 10 years younger as the spousal beneficiary. So presumably we had a relatively long payout coming in that was now going to shift over to a much shorter payout. Now, basically, once we make that decision, we can roll these funds into essentially our own IRA. Question 7 of that regulation makes that one pretty clear, that we could just essentially roll it into our own account and treat it as a rollover. Oh yeah, that's one other thing we can't do if we don't elect to treat the account as our own. Remember, if we have an account that is our IRA account, we can actually take a check from the account, and if it's not a required minimum distribution, we have 60 days during which we could put it into another account, treat it as a rollover. Presuming we do that only once per year, we're fine. If, however, that's an inherited IRA account, once you've taken those funds out of the account, you can't put them back anywhere. So if you take a cash distribution, you can't say, oops, I didn't mean to do that, and put it back in within 60 days. So there's no chance to have second thoughts, shall we say, on a distribution and put it back in, nor can we elect to move the account from one custodian to another by taking a distribution from that custodian and then depositing it in a new custodian, which is sometimes a more effective way to get this done than depending upon the custodians to transfer the accounts among themselves. The key thing we give up, however, and in this case, in the G case, the key thing she gave up because she was under age 59 and a half was the exception to the 10% early distribution penalty under Section 72T. If we receive a distribution as a beneficiary of the account, our age doesn't matter, because Section 72 T2 Cap AII provides that a distribution made to a beneficiary on or after the death of the owner of the account is not subject to the 10% penalty tax. So therefore, that one advantage we have receiving it as a beneficiary, if our age is not above age 59 and a half, is we can escape the 10% penalty. Once we convert the account to our own, it would appear, and the G case will end up holding, I think most of us had presumed this anyway, that once we make that election, treat it as our own, the distributions will be judged based upon our age and not deemed to be a distribution of the proceeds from the account of our deceased former spouse, subject to the exception as death benefits. Now let's take a look at the facts of the G case. In the G case, we have an individual and her spouse passed away in 1998. At that point, that spouse was age 73. So he would have been, we presume, taking minimum required distributions on the account. And apparently, since Charlotte was able to roll that distribution over into her own name, we also would presume that it would be with her as beneficiary, who was substantially younger. Charlotte at the time was age 51, or 22 years younger than her spouse. That would have allowed us a fairly decent spread for the time to receive the distributions. His minimum distributions would have been relatively small. Now, Charlotte, at that time, instructed the IRA custodian, Payne Weber, to distribute the balance of her former spouse's IRA account, at this point just over $1 million, to an IRA account in her name that was held at the same brokerage. She essentially consolidated the two IRA accounts into one. She later transferred those accounts to a new IRA custodian, SEI, in 2000. In 2002, we have the issue arise. She took a distribution from the IRA of $977,000 plus some other additional dollars. Basically took a distribution of just under the $1 million. SEI issued a 1099 to Charlotte showing that entire distribution as being a premature distribution with no known exception coded on the 1099-R. When Charlotte filed her 1040 for the year 2002, she did not compute the 10% early distribution tax. Instead, the court noted she put a disclosure on her return that SEI had placed the wrong distribution code on the 1099-R and it should have been coded as, quote, a distribution of IRA for her deceased husband. The IRA disagreed with Charlotte's treatment. We would presume after issuing a CP2000 notice that would be mechanically generated due to having a 1099 that suggested a penalty was due. And the IRS took the position when we get to court that since she had converted the IRA to her own name, and that basically because of that conversion, we had to look at her age, and only distributions from an unconverted IRA would have been eligible for the exception based upon a death benefit that Charlotte was attempting to claim. Now, the tax court ruled on this, and one thing that I initially found interesting, because it had never occurred to me, but the tax court notes it, is that they noted the court had not previously decided whether an IRA distribution retains its character as a distribution to a beneficiary on or after the death of an employee if the distribution is of funds that were rolled over to the IRA upon the employee's death. Now, we use the term employee here, but when we talk about an IRA plan owner, you have to realize that basically employee is used to stand in for that in many places here in the code. So in this case, when we see employee referenced in those provisions, we are talking about the IRA owner, or in this case, the now deceased former spouse. Now, the court went on and summarized the position of the parties in their opinion. And the court note that the IRS is arguing that once Charlotte, as surviving spouse, decided to maintain the funds in an account that were in her name, as owner of the IRA, she became the owner of the IRA, as they point out in the regulations, for all purposes of the code, relying upon the regulation at 1.408-8 we discussed earlier, question 5. Charlotte counters that the funds were from her deceased husband's IRA. That's where the money came from. They did not lose their character as funds from the IRA. She could trace them. They were very traceable. No additional funds had gone to that account. It would be relatively trivial to compute, and apparently Charlotte had computed, how much of the funds in the account were still related to her former husband. She had not made any additional contributions to that account during that period, and she noted she did not redesignate the account as her own, and Regulation 1.408-8, A5, again, answer 5, again, seems to require this redesignation. Now, the court considered these issues and ended up siding with the IRS in this case, holding that the penalty applies once the spouse rolled over the funds into her own account, and that there was not a requirement for a formal redesignation to take place in order for the funds to be treated as Charlotte's. The court held that they found that Charlotte received the distribution from her own IRA and not from an IRA of which she was a beneficiary of on or after the death of her former spouse. We further find the source of the amount received, whether originating from her deceased husband's IRA or her own contributions, is not relevant in this case. The court recognized that she had not technically redesignated the IRA as her own. The court holds that she did not need to redesignate it officially in that form. The IRA in question was previously hers. Remember, she took the funds from her husband's account and placed them into her account. By doing that, the court held she had effectively executed a redesignation because she had rolled them into her account. That rollover itself became the redesignation. The mere fact that you could trace the funds did not allow you to still go back under Section 72 and avail yourself of the death benefit exclusion. The court held that essentially the regulation held for this purpose and all purposes under the code did specifically include the fact that you gave up your right to claim to be a beneficiary when you received a future distribution, and as a beneficiary were receiving a death benefit to escape the 10% penalty. Now, we should note that when you consider Charlotte's position, you might find that it was a bit internally inconsistent, and the court points this out. In fact, if she had taken that distribution, remember, she combined the amount of her husband's IRA with her own. The hitch is that position would seem to be at odds with what she's advocating on a return if she could combine the two. She's claiming she hadn't combined the pair together. As the court holds, she can't have it both ways. She can't choose to roll the funds into her own IRA and later withdraw the funds without additional tax because they were from her husband's IRA. The court doesn't really come out and say so, but to be honest, there's nothing in the law that allows me to take my IRA and add funds to that IRA from any other person in the world. I basically can only put funds into my IRA that are my IRA funds. So she had the right and she was eligible to roll her husband's funds into hers, but the mere act of doing that, the court notes, makes them into hers because her IRA could only receive her funds. Presuming that she did not treat that in 1999 as a distribution from her husband's IRA, which we presume she did not, and then an excess contributions to her IRA because there would have been no right to put the money into her IRA if it wasn't being redesignated as hers, then it would seem to be an inconsistent position to today go back and say, oh, no, that's really my husband's funds. Therefore, the court holds you can't have that both ways. If that rollover was valid back in 99, then it did have the effect of being a reclassification. And let's be honest, if it did not have that fact, I'm not sure we would really want the court to be holding that such a footfault situation would create the rather nasty tax consequences that would have to flow if that was not effective to redesignate as their own. What that would suggest is a taxpayer who did that and didn't do this formal redesignation ahead of time would have to pick it all up as income, and then much later, and then have to go ahead and be stuck with an excess contributions tax. A couple of very bad results that we probably wouldn't want to see happen. Now, there were a couple of issues I found interesting that weren't mentioned in the case, but I thought they were kind of interesting to consider as to what might have happened. First, note the facts of the case tell you that her husband was age 73 at her death, and so would have been receiving the required minimum distribution. So that account was in pay status when he died. The case does not say if Charlotte took the required minimum distributions in 2000 and 2001, but the account being in pay status means she had to continue to receive distributions at least as rapidly as they were currently being paid, which means we should have been receiving them over her life expectancy for those 2 years. During those 2 years, it doesn't say if she took distributions, but you would assume if she hadn't taken distributions, then we go on further. Remember, we had a couple of ways we could redesignate. If we didn't redesignate, they would still become our account. And it would appear that if it had not made distributions in those years, it should have been mechanically redesignated. Now, it's just possible the court figured they didn't have to go there because they were going to hold she had done the redesignation on the rollover anyway. But it does raise the question of, and it might have been interesting to check the briefs here to discover what the estate's position would have been, or not the estate, but Charlotte's position would have been, had they won the provision that, in essence, the mere rollover wasn't a redesignation. Was there any argument offered for why the distributions didn't matter, or had she taken distributions for those 2 years? Even more interesting then becomes, presuming if she had taken distributions, and that's why the court didn't raise the question, had SEI in those years, or perhaps Payne Weber before that on minimum distributions, coded these as death benefits in the past? And was this what had confused the matters, because in the year she took the big distribution, suddenly the tax department at SEI said, wait a minute, we think this has been converted and this is a premature distribution. In essence, did this become an issue that arose primarily due to the fact that the CP2000 got triggered? And the prior years, which most likely would have been very minor distributions, were ones that affect the IRS just didn't bother raising the penalty issue on by attempting to claim that she had converted those. It's interesting that we don't know what happened there, at least as far as the court case itself tells us. Second interesting issue is the court case doesn't say, but it would appear by implication, since they mentioned only that she had put a disclosure note on her return, that the account had been miscoded, that no 5329 may have been filed. Now, this is an important compliance issue to note. If you have a 1099-R that would indicate a penalty is due and your taxpayer qualifies for an exception, what you're supposed to do is put that amount on the 5329 in Part 1, then code the proper exception on the 5329. Now, I begin to wonder if that wasn't done simply because it would seem the court would have referenced that Charlotte had filed the 5329, indicated death benefit was the code, and there really would have been no reason to discuss or have any sort of odd disclosure about it being misdone. You wouldn't have to say it should have been a death benefit because clearly you would have noted on your reason for the premature distribution not being taxable, not being treated as a premature distribution, therefore not being subject to 10% tax, that you claim to have received it as a death benefit. That would suggest that potentially another reason why this case got to court was because the CP2000 notice was generated automatically. That is, the computer kicked it out. Had the 5329 been there, we may have had a different result, not so much because the law would have been different, because it wasn't, but because the computer system may have been different. Now, as professionals, we are required to follow the law when filing returns. But I will note a key issue that this does raise the fact that if you have a position that you know is going to generate, or you're going to take a file a return with a position that appears to be contrary to the 1099 reporting, It is important to understand if you are reporting on the return in a way that the IRS is going to, the computer will essentially at least pick up and catch why this shouldn't generate a CP2000 notice, or whether it is very likely to generate a CP2000 notice. Let us presume even that Charlotte's position was reasonable, and we'll get to that on the penalty phase, where she was not penalized because the court held this was a case of first impression. So perhaps we might even argue that Charlotte had some support. But in considering whether your taxpayer wishes to file the return as prepared, with perhaps a position that is supportable, and let's, for the sake of argument, say this position was supportable, it is important, I think, to discuss with the client both, is it being reported on a return in a form that is likely to lead to a CP2000 notice, meaning we're going to really be putting this position in front of somebody. So even though we believe it is supportable and even though we believe it meets the standards for a return position, it is likely to lead to correspondence, examination, and potentially us having to go to tax court to fight this matter. Or do you tell the client, you know, or basically do you also tell the client, and make sure that when you filed the return, if in fact the return can be filed in a format that helps eliminate the CP2000 notice, you need to consider that's the way to do it, especially since in this case, filing it in that manner, fashion, presuming there was adequate support for the death benefit distribution treatment to place it on the return, that was probably the way it should have been filed, and that would have been the proper preparation. But again, we're speculating because we don't know if that's what happened on this return, but it is an important issue to consider in preparation. But now on to the real underlying issue. It's important to go over this matter with spouses who are under age 59 and a half and inherit an IRA. They need to consider the question of, do you plan to take funds out of this account in the near future, or do you plan to let the money stay in the account either till you're past age 59 and a half, at which point you can withdraw without penalty, or at least until you're far enough down the line, enough years down the line, where you're willing to pay the 10% premature distribution penalty on amounts you take out before age 59 and a half. If the client's goal is to stretch out the distributions as long as possible, the answer is generally fairly easy. In most cases, clearly converting it to the spouse's own IRA is going to extend the payout. But if the spouse is likely to take the funds very quickly in the near future, then it's a tougher decision whether you should allow the spouse to roll it into her own name or his own name. If the spouse plans to take it in the near future, the spouse has to understand that the act of conversion is going to add to the tax cost when the money comes out. Now, that's no problem if the taxpayer is aware of that and says, yeah, I agree, I accept that, I want to roll it in my name, and then pulls the funds out. The issue is going to arise if the taxpayer decides to take the funds out in a year or two and then claims nobody told them. Clients have wonderful 20/20 hindsight, and if a year later the spouse takes the funds out, the spouse will be sure the spouse would have told you had you asked that, you know, oh yeah, I don't want to, you know, I certainly want to go ahead and have that treated, don't treat that as my own, I'm going to take it out. Secondly, make sure you don't mechanically get it converted. Remember, if you fail to take the required distribution, the regulation provides you just did redesignate. That also could produce a bad result in a case where the client misses the required distribution, goes into the next year, and withdraws the entire balance. If the taxpayer had taken a minor distribution in the prior year that would have been the minimum required distribution as a beneficiary, then the spouse, in the year in which the spouse does the conversion into the spouse's own name, or failed to do the conversion, basically took the money out, would not have paid the 10% penalty. It is probably important to document these facts in writing as well, because again, memories tend to be sketchy. Note that we need to talk with spouses, deal with this. It's not the easiest time necessarily, but you do have to be aware when someone passes away with an IRA, you need to essentially calendar out the deadlines in front of you for making these decisions and at an appropriate time communicate those deadlines to the surviving spouse. Now, in a slight update on last week's issue that we talked about with the FASB Interpretation 48 and the qualified and the issue about our more likely than not position, I did attend today a continuing education presentation where we had a discussion dealing with other comprehensive basis of accounting statements, or OCBOA statements as we tend to refer to them. And in that class, informally discussing the matter, which I have to admit, I put the instructor, Walter Haig, on a bit of a tough spot because I raised it out of the blue of wondering about the FASB 48. At least the initial impression he had was that most likely, given the fact that our issues and guidance on OCBOA, which is somewhat sketchy at best, but that our guidance on tax basis OCBOA suggests that we look to the liability on the tax return, that in fact the FASB 48 standard would not necessarily be applicable in an OCBOA tax basis situation. There, the tax accrual could be done under the standard tax test for what would be an adequately, basically supported position, where you would not have to meet the more likely than not test, and we wouldn't have this testing after 3 years and the expiration of the period for the statute of limitations. Now, again, this is preliminary. You're kind of bouncing it around, but at least we discussed and have at least some arguments and some views as to why maybe we could avoid that in OCBOA. Still doesn't help us for GAAP purposes. We still have the problem for generally accepted accounting principles statements that will be issued for periods for fiscal years that begin after December 15th, 2006, of having to meet the more likely than not for every position on the tax return. So it will be interesting to follow that one forward. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, July 29th, 2006. As always, Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. And Steve Service offers you an interesting set of newsletters, including a newsletter on this particular case this week that are of much interest to tax professionals, and you'll get those newsletters plus a number of others on a very regular basis and access to important court cases and other documents, as well as a quick summary of very interesting threads on tax discussion groups on the net. Those are available, again, if you subscribe to their services at www.lineberg-services.com. And we'll be talking to you again next week with a new tax topic. This has been the Tax Update.